From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Steve Bannon, top White House advisor and one of President Trump's closest confidants, loves The Fourth Turning. The 1997 book argues the U.S. goes through a massive crisis, war, reconstruction, every 80 years or so. The last time it happened, World War II, which puts the next great disruption right around the corner if we're not in it already. This hour on Point in our 100-day spotlight on the Trump administration, Steve Bannon, The Fourth Turning, and its fiery message of inevitable and maybe welcome upheaval. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this the way you see history, the future? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll talk later in this hour with the author, the co-author, one of the authors of The Fourth Turning. But right now, joining me from Washington via Skype is Jeremy Peters, a New York Times reporter who has explored Steve Bannon's embrace of The Fourth Turning. Jeremy Peters, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
First, I've got to ask you, you're in Washington, you must be watching. Is Steve Bannon's position in Donald Trump's inner circle secure? It looked in the last week like we might be headed for a big showdown there. I'm reading reports today that the president has said to those around him, Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner, and more, cool it, we've got to work on the agenda. Is Bannon headed out? Is he securely in? Do we know?
We don't know, and I think that's part of the problem with covering the Trump administration in general, is that things change minute to minute, and the whims of the principal are always unpredictable. I think Donald Trump has, as my colleague Maggie Haberman and I wrote the other day, a high tolerance for chaos and a unique gift for creating it. The tone is set from the top, like in all corporations or entities where there's a leader. And this leader is somebody who is really not someone I would describe as chaos averse.
Introduce us. We know that Steve Bannon has been hugely influential. He played an enormous role in the home stretch of the Trump campaign that brought victory for Donald Trump. He's a guy with a really interesting background, and this book sits in it. It's not the only thing he's read that influences him, but it seems to be kind of formative to the way he looks at the world these days. Introduce us to the thesis of the book, The Fourth Turning.
So, you know, despite the characterizations of the book as being, you know, out there, I think that what's important to understand about it is it takes a view of history that has been accepted by, you know, a number of prominent historians, Arthur Schlesinger, I think, being chief among them, that history is cyclical, that just like the seasons turn and spring turns to summer, turns to fall, turns to winter, there is a cycle of birth, growth, decline, and death. And the societies are not immune from these turnings, as the book describes them. I think where the authors butt heads with most academic historians is in, you know, the certainty that these events occur on, you know, a rather predictable 80 or so year cycle. The reason it's so formative to Steve Bannon's worldview is that Steve has always been somebody who deeply, deeply mistrusts the elites, as he would call them, you know, the governing class, the political class. And he believes that they have gotten us into a mess that we cannot extract ourselves from unless we completely demolish and tear down the institutions that the elites have allowed to become so corroded, and corroded because they have been used to enrich the powerful at the expense of the public, really.
And The Fourth Turning kind of affirms that point of view, because he wants to tear it down. The Fourth Turning says, well, the destruction is coming. They've got this four-part cycle of growth, maturation, decay, and destruction. And in their telling, we're lined up now for destruction.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I think this is so resonant, Tom, with Bannon, because as long as I've known Bannon, Bannon has always been a disruptor. I mean, before he joined the government, which, you know, I don't even think that in his wildest dreams he ever thought that he would be, you know, at the right hand of the president of the United States. But as long as Steve Bannon has been involved in politics, his goal has always been to disrupt the established order. And that applied mostly to the Republican Party. I mean, Steve always gets characterized as a conservative populist, but the brunt of Steve's aggression has been directed at the Republican Party, a Republican Party that he believes no longer represents the people who vote for it.
Where does the Fourth Turning come up with its 80-year cycle?
It looks at events in throughout history, American history specifically, you know, the Declaration of Independence from the first shot at Fort Sumter to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. These things occurred about 80 years apart
so
each.
American Revolution, Civil War, Great Depression, World War II, on that kind of cycle.
And it also traces that the reason that the authors will explain, and Neil will explain this to you later, probably more elegantly than I can, but it's also tied to the human life cycle. There's this idea that generations play an important role in history, and that each generation comes up raised and influenced by a certain set of values that are instilled to them by their parents and the culture around them. It's very environmental. This idea is that, you know, when people die, they take those values with them, and the values of a generation change from one to the other, but that those values and behavior patterns and leadership abilities remain fairly constant from one generation from one turning to the next. So you could take the first turning of the 14th century and apply that to the 19th century, and those people would share common characteristics.
They wrote this in 1997. They thought maybe we were already in this next great disruption, or certainly it was coming. Let me quote a little bit here from the Fourth Turning, a little excerpt here that goes, "History is seasonal and winter is coming." That sounds familiar now in Game of Thrones time. "The very survival of the nation will feel at stake. Sometime before the year 2025, they wrote, America will pass through a great gate in history, one commensurate with the American Revolution, Civil War, and twin emergencies as the Great Depression, World War II. The risk of catastrophe will be high. The nation could erupt into insurrection or civil violence, crack up geographically, or succumb to authoritarian rule." And if you want to hear echoes of that in Steve Bannon, it is not hard. Here was a speech he gave. This was 2011 to a group, Liberty Restoration Foundation, a conservative group, cited Neil Howe and William Strauss's generational theory, said America is at its fourth great crisis point in history. Here's Bannon.
If the elites are so good, how did we get in this jam? Right? And but here's the part that that's why groups like you, I'm not promoting you. If you don't hang together, this country falls apart. Well, becomes something very different at the other side of this crisis, because this is the fourth great crisis in American history. We had the Revolution, we had the Civil War, we had the Great Depression of World War II. This is the great fourth turning in American history.
We're going to talk in a couple of minutes with one of the authors of the Fourth Turning. Jeremy Peters has written about it for the New York Times. Steve Bannon, Jeremy, believes, I think, that we're already in this crisis, that it's kind of begun, including a war angle.
That's absolutely right. I think that the degree to which the war becomes more severe is something that Steve would. It's a little hard to pin him down on that. He's certainly not as he is as quick to throw around predictions of global war as he may have been before he became chief strategist.
But he told you even recently, he said, "I don't think there's any doubt that the world is in the beginning state of a crisis that it can't avoid." I guess he points, it seems that he looks at a sort of Islam versus the West or something as his war frame at this point.
Right, there is this clash of civilizations aspect to the worldview that is undeniable, and that's why I found this book so intriguing. I mean, it's not just a roadmap to Steve Bannon's brain; it's also kind of a blueprint to the America First agenda that President Trump has embarked on here. And to listen to Steve explain everything that they've done, from calling for a larger military budget to loosening the rules of engagement on the ground for the military when it fights ISIS, to building the wall on the southern border, they see all of these steps as preparing for a crisis, or heading the crisis off, making it less severe than it already is. I think, though, the question that you inevitably ask yourself is, all right, Donald Trump is somewhat of a crisis president, and a lot of that is crisis of his own making. I mean, he's not proven, you know, remarkably deft at governing smoothly.
But he portrayed the world in crisis at the convention in Cleveland, and certainly in his inauguration, American Carnage.
Exactly. So, I mean, but does this prophecy then become self-fulfilling? I think is something that those who feel like Trump is an instigator of crises rather than someone who diffuses them, it's a question that they will no doubt ask.
Self-fulfilling, Steve Bannon has had the view that we're already in this. Here he was. This was 2014, delivered a speech via Skype during a conference at the Vatican. Steve Bannon.
I believe that we've come horribly off track in the years since the fall of the Soviet Union, and we're starting now in the 21st century, which I believe strongly is a crisis both of our church, a crisis of our faith, a crisis of the West, and a crisis of capitalism. And we're at the very beginning stages of a very brutal and bloody conflict.
Steve Bannon there in 2014, now that's and has been in the White House at the ear of the president. Jeremy Peters, it sounds as though you can kind of feel this view informing some of the way, maybe a significant way, the Trump administration has performed.
Yes, no, absolutely. And as you point out, in Donald Trump's remarks, whether or not he's talking about crime in Chicago, or, you know, this American carnage must end, or the undocumented immigrants in the country who are committing crimes, there is a definite sense of siege. And I think that the worry that a lot of Trump and Bannon opponents will have is to what end do they use that siege mentality? Because, of course, if the world is in crisis, it's a lot easier to justify harsh actions on behalf of the government.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Steve Bannon's deep interest in, maybe obsession, with the book The Fourth Turning and its message of imminent upheaval, maybe world war, a book that almost says, depending how you read it, bring it on. You can join us this hour. Do you see history like this, as a predictable cycle of war and crisis, starting over, disillusion, war again? Does it give you the willies if Steve Bannon thinks it's time for the war and crisis part again? Are you already getting ready? And as you listen to this and think it through, what is Steve Bannon, a prepper at the president's side? Or, wise man looking out on the world? Jeremy Peters is with us. He's been writing about this for the New York Times. Lots of talk about who's on top in terms of having the president's ear lately. Steve Bannon off the National Security Council, inner circle there. But over the weekend, we had the National Security Advisor, General H.R. McMaster, telling Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday that Bannon's removal from the Principals Committee of the NSC isn't as significant as it might appear. He said Steve Bannon would continue to counsel President Trump on a wide range of issues. Here's McMaster.
The president can get advice from anybody he wants, and he does that. He asks a broad range of people who he trusts, and Steve Bannon's one of them, about policy decisions and about, you know, the risks and opportunities involved with each of these. And so that none of that has changed.
Jeremy Peters with The Times, please stand by there in Washington. With us as well from Washington right now is Neil Howe, co-author with William Strauss, who has since died, of the 1997 book The Fourth Turning. Author, demographer, consultant, managing director of demography at Hedgeye Risk Management, an investment research firm. Neil Howe, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great to be here, Tom.
You have experienced Steve Bannon's enthusiasm for the ideas in your book, I guess.
That was, you know, long after we wrote it, and collaborated with him loosely on a number of film projects he did. I really agree with Jeremy. I was kind of shocked when he First of all, took over Breitbart, but that was a very accidental situation involving a close friend. And then, after that, came to the fore in the Trump campaign. I've not really been in touch with him at that time, but I've certainly, worked with him prior to that.
You wrote it in 1997. That's 20 years ago now. That's a long time. People's thinking evolves, and you've had a chance to watch more unfolding of events. Do you still feel, Neil, that we're on the precipice of some great disruption, economic or war? Does the world look that like it's conforming to your expectation?
Well, you know, I think it's important to take a step back. When Bill and I, the first book we did together was called Generations, and it appeared in 1991, and it was a massive undertaking. It was kind of retelling the entire story of America as a succession of generational biographies. And at that time, we really had no interest in looking for cycles. We were looking at generational differences of the sort that a lot of boomers, today realize we were so different from our own parents. And now, of course, we're a little bit different from our kids. And we were interested in that dynamic throughout history. Along the way, we perceived that there was a pattern of generational differences. And then it was only really at the very end of that we realized it was actually linked to a certain pattern in moods and events itself, sort of the overall broad contours of our history. And I should point out that as equally significant as what we call fourth turnings, which are times in which we, remake our outer world of, politics, economics, and empire, the kind of thing you've been talking about. Mm-hmm. We also point out what we call our second turnings, which are the great awakenings of American history, when we reshape our inner world of values, culture, and religion. And a very different kind of generational configuration is almost always present at those moments.
There's beauty and prosperity in the cycle that you describe too. But you really get our attention when you say, "Well, okay, but you're at the precipice of the disruption now, folks."
Well, yeah, and what we pointed out in our book in 1997 was that in our timing we would enter this fourth turning roughly sometime in the middle of the next decade, in the 2000, to 2010 decade, we suggested it would probably start with what we called a great devaluation, and it would lead to a period that would be somewhat similar in overall social mood to the 30s. I think overall, there are a lot of parallels. You look back over the 10 years and last 10 years, and I think you see obviously economic parallels to the 1930s and in the wake of a great crash and the underemployment of labor and capital and weak and disappointing economic growth and growing inequality and fears of deflation and secular stagnation, all of these terms that have come back from the 30s that we've resurrected in the last few years, debt deflation and so forth from Irving Fisher. But I think even geopolitically, we recognize similarities. You look around the world today and you see the rise of nationalism generally, and in particular, right-wing nationalism and conservative social values attached to, kind of left-wing economics attached to sort of right-wing politics. This is new. We last saw that in the 30s. You see that today. And I even think in terms of social trends, we see many similarities. Decline of home ownership. The rise in multifamily, generational living. People are living together again. We see
that hardly sounds like a great disruption. Step up to the disruption, Neil. You're going to hit it your next Civil War or World War II scale event, and then just talk about multifamily housing.
That is a huge change. Okay, one of the most unrecognized social events of the last 10 years. But let me tell you how we describe a fourth turning as a generation long era. So it lasts for 22 years. We're not even halfway through it yet. Okay, so what we describe is every fourth turning has a number of stages. It starts with a catalyst, in which case that was 2008. We had that. That was the biggest financial disruption meltdown since 1929 in the world. And it followed by what we call an increasing sense of distrust, almost an abandonment, turning against institutions by the public and voters. And I think Trump is a representative of that. And I think it's important to realize Trump is not, you know, he's blamed for like furthering a crisis, but he was voted into power precisely because he was a wrecking ball. He was a destroyer. That's why people wanted him in there. And I think you're always looking one way at the causation from, you know, what's Trump going to do? And you're looking, why did people vote this guy in? I think people knew what he was about. And I think, too, that the forces of populism, you recall back in the in the campaign, how often Trump used Bernie Sanders as a club to beat up Hillary with, you know, and allied with him on various issues, you know, that were populist in nature. Now, I think, is Steve Bannon dictating policy? No. You know, when it comes to things like repeal and replace or cutting back Dodd-Frank or all of those things, I don't think that's Steve Bannon speaking. But I do agree with Jeremy when it comes to his inaugural address and parts of his, you know, joint session in Congress. I think you do get a sense of the tone and flavor of Steve Bannon's message. But the period will go from a catalyst. It will eventually go to what we call a regeneracy, when people begin to find a new source of social trust, a new set of institutions.
You're talking on the other side of calamity.
I'm talking about in the very near future, as things get worse, people begin to sort of surge toward one party or another. It becomes a very unstable equilibrium. And then ultimately you have a crisis. And then finally, at the very end of the turning, you have a resolution. That's when the treaties are signed and the huge institutions are created that governs the world peacefully. From then on, this has been the pattern of fourth turnings historically. Again, I just want to emphasize, I'm an historian. I love describing things. So I'm not a prescriber. You know, I don't sit there asking, you know, telling people do this, do that. I'm simply saying this is what happens.
I don't know about that. I mean, I see you as a demographer looking over time here. But I mean, just reading excerpts here. I mean, you wrote the fourth with Bill Strauss. The fourth turning will trigger a political upheaval beyond anything Americans could today imagine. You also, it's prescriptive. You said we should shed and simplify the federal government in advance of the crisis, capital C you use, by cutting back sharply on its size and scope without imperiling its core infrastructure. That sounds like Steve Bannon talking in the White House to me.
Well, it's what we inevitably do. And let me just say with regard to—
Should is a prescriptive word.
There was a chapter at the end when we said, what should people do? And part of it was personal, what should people do in their personal lives? And the other part was, what should institutions do to sort of get ahead of the game or to think what we call pre-seasonally, you know, prepare for what's coming rather than what's happened, right?
Winter is coming. And,
winter is...
that's right. That's you.
The Game of Thrones there. But
before the Game of Thrones, that's you. I want to just take... Steve Bannon took it and ran with it in his film. Back in 2010, a film called Generation Zero, and he quoted Newt Gingrich in there talking about moments of choosing in American history. Here was Gingrich as offered to us by Bannon.
In those three periods of choosing, people had to decide what kind of country we were going to be, where we were going to go as a nation, what our future was all about, and what values we held. I think we are entering a similar period that'll probably last 20 years and be an ongoing, continuous challenge. When this is over, we won't be the country we have been. The choices over the next few years are among the most profound we will have seen in all of American history.
Co-author of The Fourth Turning, Neil Howe, is with us. I hear you there, Neil.
Let me respond to that. So Newt Gingrich was a supporter, certainly, of our book when it came out. I will say, though, probably our most prominent supporter of our book when it came out was Al Gore. And I would say probably of the first decade after, you know, during the 90s and early 00s, our most prominent friends were Democrats. And what they loved about our book was its depiction of the millennial generation. You know, we sort of came up with that formulation, and these were going to be community-oriented, optimistic team-playing kids who would vote mainly Democratic. And we totally went around with that. We still agree with that. They are. We predicted that. And so we have pieces out there that different parties and different leaders look toward. So it's a bit of, maybe you could say, a Rorschach test.
Yeah. I'm reading the Rorschach test here. You wrote, in a fourth turning, the nation's core will matter more than its diversity. Team, brand, and standard will be new catchwords. Anyone, anything not describable in those terms could be shunted aside or worse, You wrote, if you belong to a racial or ethnic minority, this is from The Fourth Turning, brace for a nativist backlash from an assertive and possibly authoritarian majority. Jeremy Peters with New York Times, Neil Howe, co-author of The Fourth Turning, stand by. Ron in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air, Ron. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I have no quibble with the theory. It's an interesting theory, and as a student of history, there are much longer cycles like this. But what I'm despondent about is the potential for the powers that be to use this theory to do all kinds of very destructive things to our country and our people. So that's my concern. And
What? What's your concern? What do you mean, Ron? Like what?
Well, the decision to cut so many people off health care, to me, seems to be a way to exacerbate these kind of catastrophic end times. In other words, what it seems to me is they're actually trying to accelerate this as opposed to trying to give us a soft landing. I mean, building a wall or shooting missiles is not going to feed or help people in Appalachia who have no jobs with parents who are addicted to opioids. I mean, it's a ridiculous assumption that those folks are somehow being served by an administration which uses a theory like this to hide behind the machinations of billionaires who are shifting wealth back into their own pockets.
Ron, we've got it. And it's important for you to know that there are plenty of people who do more than quibble with this. I mean, it's got very, very tough critics, and there's plenty of grounds on which to look at this and see things otherwise. Neil, I'll bring that to you. But Jeremy Peters, you're with us here. What about, has this taken on a self-fulfilling angle, as Ron worries, that once you buy into this, you kind of, there's a sort of bring it on flavor because on the other side is Valhalla?
I do think, knowing Steve Bannon as I have over the years and first meeting him as somebody who was the head of this pirate ship media company, Breitbart, there is a desire to tear down what he sees as broken, corroded, and ineffective establishment systems in our society. And I think that what you can quibble with is the solution there. Okay, so do you accelerate that destruction? Do you, as the caller said, try to give us a soft landing? I think there are a lot of people who would say that Trump and Steve Bannon are, in fact, accelerating this. I don't know that that's how they would necessarily see it, but there's no doubt that if you believe that crisis is upon us and that a worsening crisis is imminent, that you are going to seek to do things that not only disrupt but dislocate and destroy what we've come to know as our societal norms.
Neil, whether you intended it or not, are you encouraging people to kind of race toward the rapture here?
No. I want to come back and say I'm describing what is simply.
Maybe
what
not everybody agrees with you on that. Well, you could have a progressive or linear view of history that would have nothing to do with this.
Let me actually address that because it's kind of interesting, and we have a long discussion of linear, cyclical, and chaotic views of time in our book, and it's very interesting in the West, you know, and the great monotheisms are very oriented around a linear view of history. You know, history starts at one place and it ends, you know, and the idea is to get there. But it's interesting that pre-modern societies, and particularly Eastern societies, have a much more cyclical view of time. All of the first translations of our book into foreign languages, by the way, have all been into Asian languages. Kind of curious to me, you know, into Mandarin, Chinese, Japanese, or recently Vietnamese. And the Confucian cultures are very oriented around generational change and very much in tune with cyclical ideas of history.
Yeah, you know, I spent in 10 years West, in Asia. I get it. But I'm kind West, of devoted also to the West, where we're masters of West, our destiny, Neil, where West, we jump in and in work the, on it.
Okay, let me just finish that sentence. In the West, we are very much oriented toward this idea that either through our faith or through technology, we will kind of jump out of history, right? Well, there's going to be this period, this plateau. We're going to kind of escape it, just, you know, in another 5 years or something. But you look at these patterns, you say, well, they do tend to. It doesn't mean that we don't face all kinds of choices. We can navigate these periods well or poorly, and we discuss that extensively in our book. This is not anti-choice. It is simply saying, be aware of the season you're in.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. At On Point, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, it'll just take a couple of minutes to complete. If you go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com, to complete the survey right now, we'd really appreciate it. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. This survey will be really helpful to us, so thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Steve Bannon's deep interest in, maybe obsession with, the book The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe and William Strauss. And its message of imminent upheaval, maybe world war, a book that almost says or can be read as saying, bring it on. Neil Howe, co-author of the book, is with us. Jeremy Peters from the New York Times is here. He's been writing about this lately and the role it plays in Steve Bannon's thinking. You can join us. What do you think? Does expecting a crisis make it more likely to come? What about working for peace, justice, equity, international harmony, the things that might hold a crisis at bay or make a better day? What's your question for Neil Howe, the guy who wrote the book? What's it mean to have this perspective in the White House? I want to swing to the other side of the country, Eugene, Oregon, and Joseph Lowndes, professor of political science at the University of Oregon. He looks at conservatism, social movements, race relations, elections, author of From the New Deal to the New Right. Joseph Lowndes, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the thesis of The Fourth Turning, the book that Steve Bannon has apparently been so enamored with for a while?
Well, you know, the idea of historical cycles is definitely compelling. It makes the world seem understandable, that it has order, that it is coherent, it's predictable. And you can see why people have availed themselves of cyclical theories of history over time. I think it's particularly attractive for people who want a clear roadmap for how to act politically. But I think, I'm not sure that it's kind of an odd theory of history in some ways, and I'm not sure it's one that most historians subscribe to, at least anymore. Schlesinger might have been the last one to really talk about kind of broad cycles in this way, although I think historians and political scientists do talk about maybe smaller cycles. I think some of the problems with it are that, you know, it presents societies as unitary entities, kind of hermetically sealed from others, driven, you know, entirely from within in terms of it's what will happen to them, what their destinies are. And I think, you know, the other side of that is that this theory tends to gloss over major distinctions within society, class, gender, race, region, politics, religion, et cetera. And so you have, you know, people kind of clumped together generationally, but there are all kinds of differences and all kinds of, different perspectives and experiences people live with day to day in the world.
What do you make of the basic sequence? They would maybe call it a rhythm, Neil and Howe and William Strauss would have, of American history, the American Revolution, Civil War, Great Depression, World War II, this sort of 80-year intervals that led them to say, well, you know, look around, it's coming, winter is coming.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a way, if you set up a framework like that, you can almost put anything into it and interpret it, you know, along the terms that you've set up and say that, well, look, this in the 1850s looks like this in the 1990s. But you could, you know, you could maybe also say that, you know, they say the 1930s looks like the, you know, the aughts or, you know, early into the 21st century. But you might also say that today looks much more like the 1890s than it does in the 1930s. So I think there's different ways you can kind of mix and match your historical eras. But I think that, you know, partly the problem is this kind of overarching framework. You know, different institutions develop along their own time frames, driven by diverse causes and influences. Different social and cultural dynamics follow different trajectories. Economic change develops along different timelines than others. And so I think that it's not that you don't see some patterns in history. It's just that you don't see them I don't think, all at once in these kind of like, you know, giant unifying way.
Neil Howe has been interviewed and said, you know, there has to be a period in which we tear down everything that is no longer functional. Does your historian's view look at the way societies function in that way, Joseph Lowndes?
Yeah, I don't think that you could say. I mean, there are always crises. There's always, you know, there's always things that are going through changes, going through, you know, maybe regeneration or decomposition or, you know, whatever, depending on whatever social or cultural phenomenon you're looking at, whatever institution you're looking at. So, but I don't think you can make any kind of predictions that there's some large looming crisis that is going to, you know, arrive conveniently at the end of an 80-year cycle or you know, with, I think they give it a few years wiggle room one way or the other. But I don't think that, you know, that starts to look a little bit more like, I don't know. It is, as you discussed earlier in the hour, it looks more predictive and prescriptive than it does actually historical in a real sense.
Well, we'll look at that. We've got a great panel assembled here and lots of callers coming in for all three of you. Neil Howe, Jeremy Peters, and Joseph Lowndes with us here from Eugene, Oregon. Alfred in Providence, Rhode Island. Alfred, what's your observation or question?
Hi, Tom. I'm no fan of Steve Bannon or the Trump administration, but I think that there is a sense that there's going to be some sort of a great shakeup. I think that the incredible irony of that is that, you know, Steve Bannon and Trump are both symptoms of this shakeup happening, and they're also, you know, causing the shakeup. I mean, they want the shakeup. Trump couldn't be there if it weren't for there being some kind of a crisis underlying our society. And I just feel that this is probably going to be exacerbated as we have this increased tendency towards the surveillance state that we're having with the technology is permitting.
So where do you think we're headed, Alfred? Where do you think we're headed?
I worry that we are heading towards a totalitarian regime that's unlike anything that the world has ever seen because of technology. I think people aren't going to be able to fight security systems that can essentially penetrate every aspect of their lives, and that once the powers that be have this kind of power, and they realize that there's nothing that can stop them. I mean, it used to be, you know, you could have a revolution, you know, the French Revolution or the Communist Revolution, the people could rise up. Okay, that may not be possible anymore. And if this tendency towards consolidation of power and wealth just continues, I'm not sure what can prevent that from becoming just unbelievably oppressive. I mean, far worse than anything Orwell imagined.
Alfred, let us pick it up right there. Neil Howe, how do you, I mean, I realize you've looked across time, this is the rhythm you've seen, but there seems to be a risk here that, you know, humans have always had a kind of millennialist view as well, apocalyptic, the end is nigh, and we know a lot of those guys walk around forever with that sign, and the end doesn't come. I mean, the sense that Alfred says it feels like there's a great shakeup coming, all right, well, you could look at it that way, or you could say, you know, half full. Gosh, we've made a lot of progress. Let's make more. Let's get going. How do you keep this from going, from feeding an apocalyptic predisposition? And once you empower that, how do you keep it from authoritarianism, Neil?
Well, an apocalyptic end of history, so to speak, is exactly what we argue against in our book. You know, that's kind of history coming to an end, right? Or just having a terminal point.
Let's stipulate that World War II is kind of apocalyptic. The Civil War was kind of apocalyptic for this country. If you are saying we're headed towards something on
World
that scale.
World War II rid the world of some of the greatest threat to liberal democracy ever known. I think it was an enormous positive change in the world
that we defeated the Axis powers. You had millions and millions and millions who died. It's not something that one would steer toward, given a choice.
Yeah, but you have to fight them somewhere, you know? You fight them on the beaches. I mean, what are you going to do, Tom? Look, you know, it gets to this point, too. I mean, you know, we're talking about, is this just occur in the United States? And the point is no, it occurs in not only in America, but throughout all of Europe and in East Asia, which have generally shared our you know, kind of generational timetable. They both had the Great Depression and World War II. They had the People's Republic of China. They had the same basic overall contours. We had the late 60s. They had the Cultural Revolution. But it's very interesting to me that we see the same trends globally. They aren't just here. You see Brexit. You're going to see an election in France in just a few weeks. You know, these movements are all in touch with each other. This is not just confined to us here in the 48 states or the 50 states. And I wanted to respond to one other point, and this had to do with the nature of rhythms in history. And in fact, many social scientists, and we've taken huge advantage of the enormous growth in social history over the last 30 years, but you look at the long wave or the K wave in economics, the long-term theories of realigning elections, Klingberg's, foreign policy cycles of drug abuse and family life, and particularly interesting periodicities of revitalization movements in all societies, particularly work done by Anthony Wallace. I just think that there is a lot of rhythms out there that people have noticed. It's all we were trying to do is give sort of an organizing framework to this and to suggest that one thing that may generate its periodicity is the nature of generational aging. That's what actually gives a cycle of, whether it has a cycle of 200 years or 5 years, we think there's a reason having to do with generational aging that actually gives it a periodicity. That's all we were suggesting.
Okay, but when you say you have to fight them somewhere, that presumes a them, and that presumes the fight rather than let's figure this out. I want to get a caller here. Ben in Columbia, South Carolina. Ben, you're on the air with Neil Howe, Jeremy Peters, Joseph Lowndes.
Hi, Tom. I read The Fourth Turning about 7 or 8 years ago, and I enjoyed it. I was kind of intrigued by it. And, occasionally I go on the internet and read about some of the people who have taken those ideas, such as, say, the Burning Platform. And what I have become really disgusted by is it seems like the ideas that they espouse have been adopted by a lot of racist and Islamophobic thinkers. And I would love to get the author's opinion on what he thinks about that. I mean, is he down with that? Is that fine with him? Or
Neil Howe, what's your answer? Thank you, Ben. Neil?
You're looking at different websites. I mean, please, forward it to me. I'm not part of that community. So that's all I can say. I talk to people about what we write all the time. And I have no doubt that there are people out there. If something's out there, people are going to use it for all kinds of weird reasons. But I'm actually not really in touch with that. So,
of course, you wrote, if you belong to a racial or ethnic minority, brace for a nativist backlash from an assertive and possibly authoritarian majority. Scott,
okay. Well, that's a little unfair to. No. Yeah, but you don't give me any chance to respond to that. Basically, what we were saying is the nature of populist movements throughout history always come from the majoritarian core. I think that's something that people don't realize, that populism and authoritarianism go together in history, and they always come from the... They are very closely twined. Again, go back and look at the
1930s. I don't think that's how you can describe the populace of the 1890s. But the other thing I think is important to look at here is this relationship between the Fourth Turning, and I don't think that Howe and Strauss mean this to be to turn us towards racism, but I do think this language of the necessity of autocratic rule, of extraordinary military violence that's meant to mark Fourth Turnings, is mapped on to a set of racial fantasies for Bannon, and is linked to his other favorite book, which is Jean Raspail's The Camp of the Saints, a racist fantasy about an invasion of France by a fleet of starving, dark-skinned refugees, and that leads to an uprising of black and brown people throughout the world who destroy white civilization. And you can see how these two kind of ideas can work together and work together almost seamlessly in Bannon's own mind.
Let me get Asiya in Boston. Okay. Asiya, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. So I have a PhD in statistical modeling, and my job is actually I'm a data scientist. I'm working on predictive models. And I think some trend that we always see in our field is that if you give me a data and tell me that you want to fit this specific model on this data with 100% accuracy, I can give you that model. And with 100% accuracy, the problem is that that model is not predictable. There is no predictability in that model. There is actually a very good example of that. The model that was predicting the location of planets before the actual model, with the assumption that Earth is the center of the universe has 100% accuracy. Yeah. And that's the danger that we always see in a statistical modeling. And even if I do that mistake in my business, I'm going to destroy our business, which is the market, financial business. How come we are making a prediction on a historical data, which is by nature is very random, is not predictable at all, and we make sure that our model is predictable, and based on that, we're making decisions about the whole country. It's just, it to me, it's super suspicious, because even history data is more undeterministic and random than any other data out there.
Asiya, I really appreciate your call. I want to get one more. Scott in Omaha. Thank you, Asiya. Scott in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on, Scott.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. I'd like to echo the previous caller's take on this. I'm a professor. I'm a historian here. And I teach my students, the first thing I teach my students is that there are no cycles. History isn't predictive. We're not in the business of creating a certain kind of paradigm so we can understand the future. We have to interpret the past. This is a kind of conspiratorial take on the past. It's comforting to think there might be reoccurring patterns. It's just not. It's not the way.
But what do you say? The American Revolution, today. The Civil War, the Great Depression, World War II? I mean, you know. You
simply can't compare the 18th century to the 21st century in a meaningful way to come up with a prediction for the future. So the ancient Greeks, the medieval Islamic historians, they viewed history in a cyclical way. The positivists in the 19th century, they searched for laws of history. We just don't do that anymore. Karl Marx did it. We don't do that today in the 21st century.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Neil, our time is short.
Indeed, historians no longer do, and I think that's actually a poverty of their profession. I've worked with historians now for years, and that's my complaint. They simply assert there are no patterns, therefore they can't see them.
Jeremy Peters, is this at work right now in the White House, this view?
Well, that's what I think is so fascinating about this book and its role in Steve Bannon's worldview, is that regardless of what you think about the historical merits of the theory, there's no doubt that it's being used to shape policy. And that by that I mean that if you look at what the White House has done, that the aggressive steps they have taken on immigration, on the military, on spending, it's definitely geared toward anticipating some type of catastrophe. Now, the degree of the catastrophe, we don't know. And I think that the White House would argue that these policies will help mitigate whatever catastrophe that is.
Boy, somebody reads a book, you never know where they're going to end up. Steve Bannon, right in the White House at the elbow of the president, at least for now. Neil Howe, that's a long ripple from 1997. We're grateful to you for being with us this hour.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeremy Peters of the New York Times, our thanks to you, and Joseph Lowndes at the University of Oregon, thank you very much as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.